So I'd now ask you to welcome Archbishop Rowan and Frank Skinner in conversation.
Good crowd.
Good crowd. Good evening, everyone. And I think we've already had some very good input from our cardboard cutouts, haven't we?
Yeah. They've made mine slightly shorter and the Archbishop's slightly taller. So whoever made them is obviously knows which side their bread's buttered around here. But no, it's lovely. Where are they? We might be glad of them later. Are they gone? Okay.
Frank, lovely to have you here.
Thank you. It's a lovely place you've got. Do you do it yourself?
Well, bit of help with the garden.
Yeah.
Ever since it was announced that we were going to have this conversation, people doing interviews with me on television have said, why on earth have you asked Frank Skinner to come? And I wonder whether you've got any thoughts on why people think it's surprising that I've asked you to do this.
Well, to be honest, when I got the phone call, I was a little surprised myself. But I don't know if you know this, I live in a flat which is directly next to Lambeth Palace. And we are neighbours, basically.
There goes the neighbourhood.
Yeah. So I thought you basically asked me, hoping to get a lift home.
Well, it is Friday night.
Exactly. I know you like a drink on a Friday. I'm nominated driver. No, well, I was very excited because at the end of the day, it's the Archbishop of Canterbury. I mean, it's an away game, I know, but it's in Canterbury Cathedral. I'm not going to get a chance like this again. So I didn't hesitate. And also, I'm a bit of a fan of yours, if I'm going to be quite honest. Because someone once said to me, well, not very long ago, said, are there any celebrities who you'd like to have as, when you see them, you'd think, I'd like to have that celebrity as a friend? Because there are celebrities who you might admire, who you think, well, I wouldn't actually want to hang out with that person. And I said, well, it'd be the Archbishop of Canterbury and Tracy Emin.
In that order?
Well, alternate nights, I thought. I thought we could, not necessarily, we didn't hang out together if you're frightened. But I knew he wouldn't like a Catholic being in here. I met Tracy Emin shortly after that, and I wasn't so keen after. But then I met the Archbishop, and I think you're a good man.
Well,
it's all right
one.
To say that. Yeah. At the moment, we've got 90 minutes to go.
I might
go right off you.
But, I mean, coming back to that question,
yes.
People say, now here is one of these cutting-edge comedians who swears and tells rude jokes.
That is
true.
Do you
want somebody like that in a cathedral? And I suppose the answer is you want them very much in a cathedral, really. Keep them away from other places.
Yeah, I won't be, can I say I won't be doing that tonight? I mean, horses for courses. But I don't know, I've always imagined, and you may think this ill of me, but I've always imagined that Jesus and the disciples, 13 blokes hanging around, getting food where they can, moving about, there's probably quite a lot of swearing and ribald conversation. I don't find that an unholy thought. I think if God's going to become man, it's no good in becoming some slightly pious, distanced version of man. He's got to get down there with the people. So I know it's not in the scriptures, but you know, you just wouldn't write those bits down. But I wish, one of my great regrets about the New Testament is that I don't think there's one, what I would call a good gag in there from Jesus. And I mean that with passion, because I think that would have brought more people in And I think it would have made him seem more human.
Yeah, and that rings a bell, because I remember when I was a teenager, a priest in our parish telling me that he'd gone to talk to the Mothers' Union about Jesus and said, we have to remember that Jesus was a real human being and he had dusty feet. Yes, they all nodded. And he went on, and he had dirty feet. Slight intake of breath. He even had smelly feet, said the curate. And that was the point at which his job was on the line, I think.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Funnily enough, I was thinking about just this question. Are there jokes in the gospel? And I think you get I have the impression, Jesus is somebody who has an extraordinary gift with words. He's witty. You know, there are sort of sharp, rather barbed sides. There are rather outrageous similes, like swallowing camels.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But it's not thigh slapping. It's wit. It's satire, often. And occasionally, I suspect, there's a very, very deliberate kind of undercutting of what people are expecting, which must have had the shock of comedy. The Good Samaritan. Jesus starts by telling a story about a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan. Now, in that world...
Also, that's a classic structure.
Englishman,
Irishman, Scotsman, basically.
Because at the time, the three categories of people that you talked about were priests, Levites, and Israelites. So people are listening to the story. Along comes a priest. Well, we all know what to think about priests. You don't expect anything from priests. Along comes a Levite, religious professional, you know. And so everyone in the audience is saying, the hero of this story is going to be an ordinary Israelite like me. And Jesus, and along came a, and you can imagine a rather long pause, and he says, Samaritan. It's a bit like telling a joke about an Englishman, an Irishman, and a chartered accountant. You know, there's the structure, and you break it down.
But it is the structure, because there's a thing in comedy called the rule of three.
Yes.
And that's exactly how that story
works.
It's not that funny, to be honest. you'll know better than I, but I can only think of one laugh in the Bible. And I think that is when, Sarah is told she's going to have a baby, and she's old. And the laugh is not even a lovely, joyous laugh. It's a ha, ha, ha. It's one of those laughs, and God takes exception to it. So the only laugh in the Bible actually doesn't go that well with God, which is, obviously what I'm looking for here is some sort of vindication for my whole life. But I think
that's why you're here, is it?
Yes. I think it's why more puritanical faiths are so stern. I mean, I kind of... in case anyone doesn't know, I'm a Roman Catholic, and I kind of associate Protestantism with a more stern, austere kind of faith. I mean, it sort of grew up... in Northern Europe, didn't it? And I always think it's a result of dark, cold nights where people sit around and think, well, let's read the Bible again. And they're all sitting like this, and they've got nothing else to do apart from tick off things that are bad for them. Whereas I imagine the Catholics in Southern Europe are saying, let's read the Bible. Well, yeah, but what about meeting some friends and having a glass of wine, sitting outside, and sharing God's love in that kind of warm and natural way?
So, essentially, you think the Reformation is the fault of the weather?
Yes.
Well, there may have been one or two other issues around.
You can imagine when the news broke, and now over to the Reformation office.
Put the weather. But I think that while there's something in that, if you look at the first generation of Protestants, if you look at Martin Luther in Germany, there's somebody you couldn't call a Puritan, somebody with an enormous appetite for life. And, I think if I were talking to him this evening and people had read some of what he was on record as saying, they'd want to know why I was talking to Martin Luther. He's
and he used some quite graphic imagery and languages.
But it is one of the things which I guess we can't get away from in the Bible, that the laughter is not obviously around there.
No.
There's lots about joy. And maybe that's what matters at the end of the day. When the laughter is over, the joy stays. But it would help a lot of people, I guess, to feel that it was permitted to laugh in church. And you need to work a bit at that. I'm even inclined sometimes to think, and this is pushing it a bit, I know, that without some kind of religious approach to reality, some kind of faith, it's actually rather difficult to find things funny, because things are funny because they're incongruous. They jar against something.
Mm.
If anything is as predictable as anything else, well, nothing much is very funny, is it?
Well, I like the idea that we're funnier than the atheists, as you can imagine. I don't imagine that Richard Dawkins is a laugh a minute.
Well, I've never heard him tell a joke.
No, but to be fair, he's still evolving. This thing about the seriousness element is something I struggle with. Now, I don't know what it's like in Anglican churches, but I find churches are one of the most difficult. I'm enjoying this sound. It's like a Velvet Underground concert. Some people are leaving already. Well, that's a worry. Was it something you said?
Probably.
How is the sound? Is it all right? Yeah, this is how I imagine tonight is one Catholic at the front. You can't hear. Okay.
Can't hear.
I knew I'd get shouted at. It was that kind of night. Okay. I'm going to keep talking, and if I say anything really funny, pass it on. Now, I don't know what the average... I'd be interested to find this out from people in the... are they an audience tonight or a congregation? It's a borderline thing. But when I go to church on a Sunday morning, I feel like we are discussing the most profound, important, serious things in the middle of a children's playground. And I find it quite difficult often just to even hear what's being said in a homily, for example. Now, in the Catholic Church, I imagine this is even worse because we're not that big on contraception, as you may have heard. So there's a lot of kids screaming and shouting. Now, I think it's a real problem. I think it makes church... I love the fact, I love kids and I love kids being around, but I kind of go there to be inspired. I kind of go there to be given something by the priest that I'll take away with me and it'll get me through that week. And I don't know what the answer. Have you ever thought about a creche?
Well,
age limit?
Not only thought about it, we do it here.
Yeah?
Yeah? And so do most parishes, I think. I think it's a difficult balance because on the one hand, it's good, I think, that children feel at home in the context of worship. They feel they're not under pressure, they're not, everybody looking and disapproving.
Mm.
I think it's good if it feels natural like that. At the same time, I really understand what you're saying about the need for a place to be serious. And I think sometimes we load too many expectations on the Sunday morning event when there are maybe things that can and should be done, and of course are done, other times during the week when you can say, the thing I half heard in the sermon on Sunday, can I ask you with, four or five other people around what it's really about and take time then? Because given the rush people live in, it's often very difficult to find the extra time for that, and so you do load it all on Sunday.
Well, I wonder if maybe I'm quite a tough crowd because I expect a lot when I go to Mass. And, you know, from the sermon, I really want something important. And maybe it's difficult to churn that out 52 weeks a year. I don't know. I think I've been going to Mass since I was about 5 or 6. And I had a few years off. I left the church when I was 17 and went back when I was 28. I had those difficult teenage things. So I must have heard thousands of homilies. And I can think of maybe 3 or 4 which really had quite a big effect on me. And if I was doing gigs with that kind of hit rate, I would not be sitting here tonight. And I wonder, I don't know how much training is given, how much help is given to people who have to preach. There was a time when people had to get a license to preach, I think.
Still do.
They still do. Well, you need to review your licensing. No, and I don't want to sit here and criticize priests, Anglican or otherwise, but I think it's a big problem. I think when I do gigs, and when any comedian does a gig, there's a film by a comedian called Jerry Seinfeld. He's a very famous American comedian. And he goes out on the road to, he hadn't done any live shows for 10 years or so, and he goes out to try new material in clubs. And he says, being famous gets you through the first couple of minutes, and then after that you've got to be funny or you'll lose them. And every comic lives on that tightrope. And we don't have a captive audience. We don't have people coming because it's a sense of duty. And I wonder if that can make you casual, and I wonder if it can make you try not hard enough. I have thought just lately, wouldn't it be better if we just found a core group of very, very good preachers who every week took it in turns to do an absolutely cracking 7-minute sermon, and that's played in on a video screen in every church in the country. That would take some of the load off that priest, and we'd be getting something really good. That's a serious suggestion.
Pretty much how it worked in the Middle Ages, I think. That a lot of parish priests didn't preach. You had experts, like the Dominican friars, going around doing things. But I think the other side of it is the local priest or deacon or lay reader or whatever preaching can key into what's actually going on in that community at that time. And they may not be able to produce memorable, coruscating, witty sermons, but they may just have something that strikes that community for that day, and that's all.
I'm not looking for gags, though. I'm really not saying that.
I'm not assuming you are.
I once saw Cardinal Hume preach, and he told a very, very short sermon. He was in Africa, and he saw this small child, and this child has lost its parents, and I think 4 brothers and sisters. Tiny child, and it was doing this. And he said to one of the aid workers, what does that gesture mean? Is that like a low? And they said, well, we've all been wondering about that, and we think he's just calling us in. He just wants people to just be close to him. He wants not just to be held, but he's just saying, please don't leave me on my own. And then he kind of ended that sermon. And that was plenty for me. I didn't need 3 or 4 topics. I went away and I really thought about that and what that meant. And now maybe, you know, lots of people have got their own version of this. And surely we could come up with, say if you did 104 cracking sermons like that, you could just have them on a loop and they'd play every 2 years. I think it's a serious problem. If we had a show of hands, can we have a show of hands? How many people here are generally disappointed with the sermon on a Sunday? Obviously, nearer the front, less hands. They even know your spectacles prescription. Row 10, we're all right.
Years ago, I used to teach sermon preparation to students in theological college, which may explain a lot of what you're talking about. But I remember one thing I used sometimes to say was, imagine you have 45 seconds to say one thing. What would you absolutely have to say? And then build around that. Don't say, I've got to fill 10 minutes. But imagine, you know, the building's on fire, as it were. You've got to say one thing and start from there. Because
can you guess what my next question is, Your Grace? What would be your one thing that you had to say?
Well, it would depend on the day, what I'd heard in...
What about tonight? Because I'd like to take something away from this that will be a glowing ember.
Right. Okay.
Shall I come back to you on that? I thought, if anyone, you'd just come out with something like that.
I don't like doing rapid responses, as people will realize who've heard me before. But it would depend on what I'd heard in the Bible reading. It would depend on maybe what I'd seen or sensed in being in the church before the service started, because I try to get there early enough at least to talk to one or two people and get a feel. Yeah, it would depend a bit on what had come up in saying my prayers. Yeah. So it's a bit difficult to do it, you know, in midair.
Yeah.
So I suppose I could turn it back and say, give me a Bible passage.
Well, I'll tell you. People who... I have lots of arguments about religion. I rarely talk to other religious people about religion. Most of my conversations are with atheists who say, how can anyone with any kind of brain believe in God in 2011? And I, you know, how can you be so sure? And my point is, I'm not sure. And in fact, I think faith is that kind of complete and utter blind faith is a very dangerous thing. And I see myself as a man of doubt. And I think doubt is absolutely at the center of being a human being. And it is important. And I worry about when I hear religious people who seem to have no doubt, fundamentalist beliefs. And I worry when I hear atheists who seem to have no doubt at all. And I think that is an essential part of being a human being. And I think that when Jesus is on the cross and he says, my Lord, why have you forsaken me? That's the moment that he completely becomes a human being. And then he can die because he's done the full works. So I don't think anyone in this church tonight who believes in God should feel bad if there are days when they find it very, very hard to believe. See, that's the other thing with sermons. There aren't enough applause. These people, they need a bit of encouragement.
Listen to this man. I've heard people say the opposite of faith is not doubt, but certainty. That is, you know, a particular kind of absolute self-satisfaction. I've got it sorted. But faith is, in my book, the confidence to take the next step. Not certainty, not knowing where it's going, but enough confidence to say, I'm not giving up. And what you quote from the Lord on the cross, I mean, that is, for me, as for many people, an absolutely crucial moment, indicating that he doesn't spare himself the most difficult of human experiences. He really doesn't.
I also think, Your Grace, that is a very good piece of evidence for the fact that the Gospels haven't been too tampered with by the people who wrote them down. Because if I was writing a Gospel trying to sell Christianity, I would have edited that bit. There's one or two really difficult bits with Jesus, some contradictory bits, some just problematic bits. You know, forget your family. That bit when he says your family's outside, and he says, who are my family? These are my family. You think, oh, that's quite a nasty thing to say about your mum. And I would have took that out. And the fact that it's in there suggests that people regard the words of Jesus as too sacred to tamper with. And that's a very good sign that we're getting real stuff, I think.
Yes. Likewise, I think the struggle in the Garden of Gethsemane. He really is afraid of what's going to come. So you're talking about a depth of feeling the distance of God or the absence of God on the cross. You're talking about a real fear of what's going to happen in the Garden of Gethsemane. You're not talking about a plaster figure. You're not talking about a Superman. And I think it's one of the things which the church kind of almost goes in waves on. There are generations where people really feel that is important. There are generations where they kind of lose sight of it and they want him to be a Superman. But I think it's crucial to come back to these things. And if it's not the case that Jesus experienced these things as human, well, then we're bound to be feeling ashamed or awkward if we feel doubt or if we feel fear. That Jesus feels them, I think, is one of the things that says to us, it's okay to recognize that, to be honest.
Yeah, I think that, like, St. Thomas, Doubting Thomas, as people call him, is kind of the classic saint for the 21st century. Because he says, get out of it, he wasn't it, I'll believe that when I stick my finger. And then when he's confronted, he's able to say, to just repent that and to just crumble at his lack of faith. Yeah. And, he's a bit of a hero of mine. I think he's got a very bad press. I mean, the adjective doubting, you don't want that tied to you forever. But I think it's important. I think the idea that religious people are certain about stuff. You know, there are days when I think maybe this is wrong. Maybe we're sitting here now and we're both wrong and there's nothing. And this fabulous place was just built on a dream. I think it's okay, anyone who's thinking that now, I think it's all right to think that. I think that's not going to be held against you.
I take it you're not going to ask for a show of hands on this one.
But I'll tell you what I would like to know. I'd quite like to know how many non-believers are in tonight.
Oh, good.
Again, they're all at the back. It's like the naughty kids at school. Okay. Not that many, but enough to cause sedition.
I think so, yes. They're the ones who haven't walked out yet.
I don't know if you're aware of this, Your Grace, but on the comedy circuit now, it's incredibly cool to be an atheist.
Yes.
I was in Edinburgh recently, and I saw several comedian shows, and even if they were nothing to do with religion, they'll take a little 3 or 4 minute slot where they say, oh, by the way, I'm an atheist, just to make sure they tick the box of cool comic. Mm-hmm. You have to wear tight jeans, you have to have hair that looks like a chrysanthemum, and you have to be an atheist if you want to be a cool modern comic. Now, you need to sort that out. No, but it's very bad that being an atheist has got to be the cool position. Because that could be very serious, you know, as an end result. And I think the atheists, sorry, I will let you talk in a minute, but but I think the atheists we might see them as people who deny global warming, that you might celebrate their right, their freedom of speech and their opinion to deny global warming. But if they're wrong and millions of other people have taken their view, then it could end in a terrible, terrible disaster for a lot of people. And the church seems to be just letting it get cooler and letting it dominate more and more. You know, the God Delusion sold, a million copies? What did your last book sell?
Not quite as much.
Well, that can't be right.
But I would also, I think, want to know how many atheists the God Delusion created, so to speak. You know, the book sold. Did it make a difference to the number of people who were actually committed one way or the other? I really don't know the answer to that, but I suspect that, you know, fashions in book sales come and go. I'm not, you know, not avoiding the point that the coolness of atheism is very much in evidence.
Yeah.
But I'm just not quite sure that it shifts people's serious commitments that much in the long run.
Really? When I read The God Delusion, because I think it's important, I don't want to be one of those believers who shots out any kind of counter-argument. And when I held the book in my hand before I turned the first page, I remember thinking, when I finish this book, I might not believe in God anymore. And I think that's important, that that's always a possibility. If someone tells me something that makes me think, no, there really isn't a God, then I won't believe anymore, simple as that. And there were a couple of moments in that book where I thought, well, that's a good point. But I came out of it, I was all right. But because I end up talking about religion a lot, because people think, oh, it's that religious weirdo bloke, this is a chance to talk to him. I think people do think that. I think that people used to be very sort of, I'd say agnosticism was the most common stance I came across. People say, well, I haven't really thought about it, but, you know, maybe not. I meet more people now who have categorically, that they align themselves with science and atheism and the new atheists and that movement. And what should we be doing anything, should you be doing anything about that? Or is it that it's just, that's life and you have to just let it unfold?
Quite a few people have been doing things about it in some ways. The problem is that it becomes a bit of a vicious circle. Atheism is cool, so books about atheism are cool. They get high profile. And books that say, actually, this, this, and this are wrong in Richard Dawkins don't get the same kind of publicity because atheism is the new cool thing, and it's the sort of dog bites man bites dog thing, isn't it? One's news, the other's not so much. So it's quite difficult to break into that. But plenty of people have tried, are trying. I think, and again, I hope this isn't a cop-out, but I think what tends to make a difference to people's sense that faith is real or possible is seeing someone's life where it works. And often that's a very local, very close-to thing. I mean, Bishop Trevor and I were at a bishop's meeting last week where we had a presentation from the Bishop of Harare.
Have you got plants in the audience?
Yes, of course.
I thought you were getting more applause than I was.
The Bishop of Harare in Zimbabwe, who was talking about what it had been like for the last 3 or 4 years being a church facing constant brutality, harassment, and how the church had grown in those circumstances. And for me, that was something which put any amount of argument in perspective. I was able to say, well, that's what happens. I can't see any way of ignoring or trivializing that. It seems to be possible for human beings to grow in their commitment, not certainty, but commitment, in those circumstances. So if I'm feeling really triumphalist, I'd say, well, explain that, Dawkins. You know, what's going on there? It's not a knockdown argument. It's just saying that's actually what reaches people's guts, rather more. Which is why I guess that the very fact of somebody like yourself professing a religious faith may be more important than your ability or mine to answer Richard Dawkins in detail.
Well, I guess it depends on what they think of us. But I think anyone who professes a belief automatically becomes a sort of representative for it. Sure. So even if you just seem happy. And
it's a start, isn't it?
Yeah, I think people are always looking. You see, I sometimes wonder, maybe it's not a bad thing that churches don't have as many people in them as they used to. I'm quite keen on quality rather than quantity. You know, there was a time when there was a big social pressure to go to church. So a lot of the people there probably didn't really want to be there, weren't that interested. And I know it often looks like the people there are not that interested, but No, but you know, I often look around during a sermon just for something to do, really. And I look at the people, and people are looking at their shoes and blah, blah, blah. But I think you never know, actually. Someone can look bored, but inside they might be thinking very profound spiritual thoughts about their life. I would never assume that. But I think anyone who's at church now, unless they're a child who's been dragged along, are there because, you know, they've made that decision. There is certainly no social pressure to go to church, on the contrary. So it might be good to have less people who are more committed. I'm even wondering if maybe the whole idea of evangelization is out of date in the West in the 21st century. Well, I think we should move more towards being a cult again. I'm absolutely serious about that. Those were our golden days when we were meeting in tiny little rooms in the Middle East and drawing fishes on walls by candlelight and being pursued by the authorities. That's when we were absolutely at our most dynamic. Imagine what those sermons were like. No one was sitting bored. I mean, we were so cool then. We really were, like, you know, that. And now we've been embraced by the state and all that, you know, not that that's a bad thing, obviously. But I think it would be good to get back to that kind of dynamic, subversive cult. No?
Well, I hope we've got just enough of that left. But the trouble is, you can be romantic about a dynamic, subversive cult, whereas the reality is we've got a lot of parishes, a lot of very average people trying to make sense of their lives. And they're not going to go back to the underground in a hurry. And tomorrow, next Sunday, the Sunday after, what do we do to get them that little bit nearer, to get myself that little bit nearer? Let's not pass it along. What do I do to get myself a bit nearer that sense of the seriousness of it? The fact that it's not just a matter of imagining that the house is on fire and you've got 45 seconds to say something. In the early church, that was likely to be true. The police would be at the door. And I think that's what we felt listening to Bishop Chad from Zimbabwe. You know, that was what the church was like there. Locked out of their buildings, meeting at real risk, beatings, killings even. And they grow. But you can't either pretend that's happening or just make it happen. And that's our problem here, I think. Somewhere in the middle, that we're trying to keep enough of that urgency and seriousness alive in conditions of, well, a very confused society indeed.
Do you sit around though with your senior bishops and things and say, what's our tactic on this?
Yes.
Have you come up with anything yet?
You mean you haven't
Don't
noticed?
Hide your light under a bushel, Your Grace.
You haven't noticed? Well, I think that one of the things we've been trying to do in the last 7 or 8 years is not just ask the question, but find the strategy that says we can, as a church, very often just wait for people to turn up to us, whereas we ought to be going to where they are rather more. Which means sitting a bit more light to the expectation that everybody ought to and will turn up here in a building at a specified time. And the sort of people who go and generate a little discussion group or prayer group in a cafe or a pub, that's something which we've seen a lot more of, and I guess we'll see more still.
And does that work?
It doesn't work in terms of huge figures.
No.
And I don't expect it to.
No.
It works in terms of keeping, well, as I was trying to say, I think, keeping some sense alive that this is serious. It needs time. You don't expect quick fixes. And you just keep it alive because it matters.